Welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. I'm Caleb, and I'm joined by Dr. Rod Rosenblatt, Dr. Scott Keith, and Dr. Adam Francisco. We are in our Great Thinkers of the Christian Church series, and what we're talking about today is a character that we've already covered once, but we didn't get to sort of the breadth of his impact. So we're talking about Thomas Aquinas once again. In the last episode where we talked about Aquinas, we had Dr. Dan Dean on the show, and we talked about sort of the early life of Aquinas, his education, and a good chunk of his philosophical impact. Today, we're going to talk about some of the theological impact that Aquinas had. We're going to finally get around to actually outlining the five ways of Thomas Aquinas and try to offer up any, perhaps, resources that we missed the last time. If you're listening to the show, you already know, but it's a good reminder that we are not going chronologically in this series, so that's why there's been episodes between the last Thomas Aquinas episode and this one. Same thing with Luther. We had Donovan Riley on to talk about Luther, and we did the early life of Luther, and we will have further episodes on that as well. The main goal of this series is to just hit as many people as we can in sort of the time frame that we have available when we can get guests who specialize on a particular person. You know, we're going to utilize them, whether we're kind of in that time period in history or not. And today, we're going to let Dr. Francisco go once
because we found out when we brought a guest on that Dr. Francisco is indeed a Neo-Thomist. So we thought we'd let him
just
delve into his expertise a little further.
But for the record, for the ones who are like
sensitive about this kind of thing,
who are snitches and things, I'm not a Neo-Thomist. I just admire.
Do we have snitches listening to the Thinking Fellows? Probably.
There's snitches all over the place.
You know what Adam says?
Snitches get stitches.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Yeah. All right.
So be warned, Thinking Fellows listeners. Snitches get stitches. We will find you.
Oh, my. No. How is that feasible on iTunes? But if I say something like darn without the darn.
Well, it's not a feasible issue. It's just like you have to put a parental warning on it. It's mostly for the kiddos.
The kiddos who probably have more coarse language than I'd ever met.
Than their parents, yeah. It's an unfortunate thing.
Thomas Aquinas.
Thomas Aquinas part two.
You know, it was funny. Before the week we recorded the Aquinas episode, I felt like I knew a little bit about Thomas Aquinas. You know, I'd studied Thomas Aquinas. I had done my share of reading in the Summa Theologiae and Summa Contra Gentiles. And then we have Dr. Dan Dean on because he's a philosopher to talk about Thomas Aquinas and philosophy. And then just Adam just goes to town. Like, he just unleashes on Aquinas. And I think, you know, I know nothing about Aquinas.
Right.
I thought that, you know, if somebody ever asked me, what do you know about Aquinas, I could actually hold a conversation until then. So we were discussing, you know, what we were going to do today because, you know, we're that organized. And we said, you know what, it seemed like Adam had a little bit more to say on Aquinas when we stopped that last episode. So since you are here, and since the, I don't see any bourbon, but you did have a beer.
Unfortunate, yeah.
Has been flowing. Why don't we let you go? And we decided we didn't actually get into too much of Aquinas' later life, and we didn't get too much into the theology of Thomas Aquinas, which is interesting because, I mean, he is known, or at least was known, or is known as the theologian of the Roman Catholic Church.
Yes.
Yeah,
he's huge.
Yeah, that's kind of one of the interesting parts about this series is we're finding, because this is different than sort of the theological topics we did before, or, you know, being able to run through the points of a theological or an apologetic argument, that on some characters, you know, we're getting to that 45 minutes pretty easily, because, you know, something's been lost in history or there's just not that much. And then others
are going to be... I didn't want to hear much more about Arndt.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then others are so significant that you can't fit them into 45 minutes. And so listeners do know that we recognize that sometimes that 45 minutes isn't satisfactory enough. So stay on the hook. So, because we will do part two, part three, if necessary, on some of these major players.
All right, Adam.
So, Yeah, just maybe to recap, if I, my memory serves me correctly, and I'm sure Caleb's going to correct me if I'm wrong.
Yes.
Young Caleb. We talked about
Young Thomas Caleb, Aquinas, who just told us before the show that he doesn't actually struggle that much with learning Latin 3, Greek 2, and Hebrew 1 at the same time.
Well, I struggle. But
yeah,
it's so much. The language stuff is like so much a rinse repeat after you've done it for a couple semesters.
Yeah, yeah. For some people. All right, go ahead, Adam. Sorry.
So, if I'm not mistaken, when we first talked about Thomas, we talked about the kind of the historical background, the background of the High Middle Ages, the recovery of Aristotle at the University of Paris. We did correct. Is this correct that we talked quite a bit about the relationship between faith and reason in Thomas?
We did. I think that's the majority of what we covered.
Okay. Yeah, we did not talk about as much about Aquinas and his mom as we did as Augustine and his mom.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, somebody said we needed to, somebody posted me in this article about, you know, great female thinkers of faith, and like one of the top ones listed was Augustine's mom. You know, I think she got pretty good coverage on
the
show.
She did for us, yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, that sounds right, Adam.
Okay. Okay. Well, we've already said that Thomas is very influential, both in terms of positive influences and influential in that a lot of people respond or react to him and his theology. An example of his influence, maybe this was mentioned in the other show, but is that if you were to go to some of the new atheist literature, I'm thinking here of Richard Dawkins in particular, mm-hmm. in his book *The God Delusion*, which is a book that purports to demonstrate that there is no good reason to believe God exists. Mm-hmm. And what Dawkins tries to do, in chapter after chapter, is show that all the arguments for God's existence that have been used are really weak. They're not, you know, sound logically or evidentially in terms of their support to the arguments. They're not worth paying attention to. What's interesting, I read years ago The God Delusion when I was looking at into all this new atheist stuff, is what I found is when Dawkins and these other new atheists go after arguments for God's existence, they bring up Thomas's version of arguments for God's existence. So arguments from the 13th century that in that philosophical context actually did work. Hmm. But then they lift them and move them into the 21st century, ignoring that there's, you know, a guy like William Lane Craig who's actually built on those arguments and has fashioned those arguments
them.
In very sophisticated ways. But they completely ignore all that and go right after Thomas. So they don't tell you that's what they're doing, but that's in fact what they're doing. But the point here is that Thomas's five ways for arguing for God's existence and his summation of theology are sort of foundational in the realm of what we might call natural theology and proofs or arguments for God's existence. And I don't know that you want to go through all the five arguments, but anybody could go on Google and just type in the five ways of Aquinas and read them for themselves.
We could do it briefly.
But, the five ways are, a lot of them are very similar. So the first argument is an argument from movement. You know, if there's movement, there's got to be some sort of movement. It's sort of, I think the way Dr. Rosenblatt put it years ago.
Billiards table.
Is the, you know, in a pool table, billiards table, if the balls are moving, it's because somebody's outside of the
arena. Has whacked it with a cue stick.
Somebody's whacked it, right? There's something that sets stuff in motion. Second argument parallels it. It's the argument from the first cause. That is, if we look around the world, we see effects everywhere.
Yeah, this is the one I think you see most often in contemporary Christian arguments.
Yeah, and there's
if there's no God, there wouldn't be anything.
Right.
Right. Yeah. It's that I think Dan Dean said it's like the question: why is there something rather than nothing?
Right. And there are a lot of philosophers who say that for our field is the basic question, and nobody's answered it.
Right. Right.
And the Christian raises his hand and said, "One group has."
Yeah.
Well, that's the one that. ASU physicist, I think it's Krauss, Lawrence Krauss, comes after pretty strongly in his book. I don't even remember the name, but he comes after first cause argument pretty heavily. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are some, in at least in Thomas's rendition of it, there are buried assumptions in the first cause argument. You know, the assumption of the impossibility of an infinite regress.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But those are pretty good assumptions, though they are assumptions. But anyway, that's...
Well, the assumption, too, that if there's... if something happened, somebody or something had caused it to happen.
Yeah, everyone is causal.
Right.
A causal chain back to the only possible explanation.
Right. Yeah. Now, and in a weird way, it's an argument from our experience. For Thomas, too, at that point, it would have been arguments from his experience, right? Mm-hmm. Our experience tells us, really, that everything that happens, happens for...
Mm-hmm.
Da, da, da.
Yeah,
if this is caused, somebody caused it.
Yeah, in defense of Thomas, one of the parts that I do like is he starts with the real world.
Right, absolutely. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Right.
And works from that.
Yeah.
Many philosophers don't.
It's an interestingly empirical argument from though it takes it on a rationally deductive sort of reasoning.
Yep.
The assumptions, though they are assumptions, they're empirical assumptions.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. And if you read the five ways in the Summation of Theology, the paragraph preceding his... or before he gets into the arguments, he actually mentions Anselm in the ontological argument.
And why he rejects it.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's a decisive
turn
epistemologically away from starting with ontology or being to starting with evidence and approaching things inductively.
And our listeners would have heard us refer to that Summation of Theology to a Summa Theologiae and Summa Theologica. It's the same book.
Yeah, yeah.
One is the Reader's Digest version.
Right, yeah. And it's variations in how you use the Latin in description of how, whether you're using the complete edition or using a more abbreviated edition. But essentially, we're talking about Thomas Aquinas' work, the Summation of Theology, which in English, too, you can get in either the greater full edition or you can get in the Reader's. Even the Reader's edition will probably be three volumes, for Pete's sake.
Yeah, the Summa Contra Gentiles was an apologetic handbook for Jesuits headed for Japan.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
To prep them.
Mm-hmm.
That's a whole other story.
I was actually going to mention that. That was where I first came across. I mean, I always heard about and read bits and pieces about Thomas, but when I started actually reading him in the primary source level and thinking about his influence in the broader history of the church is the Summation or Summa Contra Gentiles, which is this massive. I mean, I've got an edition on my bookshelf. I think it's five or six volumes long. It's huge, but it's intended to be a primer for missionaries. Jesuits later on, a couple centuries later, but even in his own day and age, Dominicans going eastward into the Middle East and perhaps even and beyond to kind of give them the basic natural theological training to how they could talk about God with people who don't share the Christian assumption that the Bible is the Word of God.
Yeah. Right. It's sort of like Paul. I see you have a statue here dedicated to the unknown God.
Yeah, it's Paul at Mars Hill, but five, six volumes.
leaving no stone
unturned.
Well, it's the medieval thinkers, they didn't specialize in brevity.
Yeah. Right. Neither did Paul. People fall out of windows and things when he speaks, but we only have little excerpts of what Paul said.
They're falling asleep.
Yeah. I am. Yeah. Yeah. Well, was it a little boy or something?
Right? Uh-huh. Yeah, it was.
Anyway, so back to the five ways. So the first is from movement. The second is from causes, or an argument from the first cause, or from looking at effects back to the first cause. The third one, paralleling the other or the first two, is an argument from contingency that says essentially everything we see, everything in the cosmos, cannot explain itself. It's contingent, or another way of saying it would be it's dependent upon something else for its explanation of why it is.
Mm-hmm.
And if everything is contingent, you need it's a causal argument. You need a cause for it.
Right.
You need a necessary being, if you will.
Again, there's a lot of presuppositions in this sort of deductive argument that he's making, but they're ones that are empirical in their assumptiveness, right?
Yeah.
So
that everybody could come to this conclusion.
Right, a tree grows from a seed, all that type of thing. There's a contingency that's built into the natural world that he recognizes and extrapolates that out into a philosophical argument.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and so those first three kind of all fall. They're the same argument, but just...
at least in form they are.
Yeah. The fourth argument, or the fourth way, is his argument from degree or gradation. And I guess to put it simply would be... We evaluate things.
Yeah.
You know, some things are good, better, and best.
Cold, warm, hot, yeah.
Yeah, and to make those distinctions, you got to have some sort of objective rule or standard behind it, that's fixed or static.
I think that's one of the best ones, to be honest with you.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
I was thinking about back when, I'm going to out you now, when we were talking about Plato years ago, because that's what we do in our spare time. Plato and art. I think we were talking about music or something, and the objectivity of art.
We were, because it was after that discussion I had with Kurt Winrich, you're right.
Yeah, and I mean, why do artists or musicians practice? Why do they try to get better?
Right.
Because there is a sense that there is an objective
good
to art and things like that.
That
assumes there's a standard of goodness, truth, and beauty that's objective.
And even though in something that seems as subjective as art or music, we don't always recognize what the good is universally. You know, we're not in agreement on that. Doesn't mean that there isn't a good that is.
Well, why I bring this up is because you accuse me of being a Thomist, and I think maybe a Platonist.
I remember
a couple of years ago. I don't have it recorded or anything that you said. Yeah, I really like Plato, so I mean, that's pretty close to saying you're a Platonist. So anyway, that's the fourth way. The fifth way is
describe myself as pretty hardcore Aristotelian. So that's
the fifth way. His fifth argument is what we call today an argument from design or a teleological argument. Basically says, at least in Thomas's context, today it's so much more sophisticated. It's incredible. In fact, Anthony Flew, in his autobiography, his intellectual autobiography, says it's the argument from design, in particular the complexity of information in a cell, that led him to acknowledge not a Christian God, but that there must be some sort of designer behind things. But the teleological argument...
Well, in his particular form of it is rather sophisticated.
Who, Thomas?
Flew's.
But Thomas is, it's pretty basic, but that things are seem to be designed or working towards a particular end shows that there's some sort of mind behind
the
it.
The telos of an acorn is an oak tree.
Those are the five ways. They're part of his... I mean, Thomas is known for his natural theology. In evangelicals... aren't so strong in natural theology, unless you're like Norman Geisler, who's a kind of a Thomist
Baptist. But he is the guy. If you're talking about natural theology, the first name that will come up is
Thomas. Yeah.
So what's the antithesis to that? What do evangelicals do instead of this?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because most evangelicals, even when I go out, and we use that. There was another term that somebody started using for it that I thought was pretty good because it's less confusing. But basically, what you're talking about is sort of vanilla, non-denominational American Christianity.
Yeah, right? In most cases, if they're trained in anything along these lines, it'll be, I know there's a God because I experienced him this morning.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the evangelicals are pretty big in intelligent design right now.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. In fact, we should, just to be fair, I've not verified this, but William Lane Craig puts it in every one of his books that over the last 20 or 30 years, there's been sort of a revival, at least in professional philosophical circles, in natural theology.
Yeah.
Should explain that. Can anything about the true God be known apart from incarnation and apart from Bible?
Yeah, through either something that's in you, you know, like your ratio, your reason, or through your observance of the natural world.
And the classic chapter is the second chapter of Romans.
Yeah. Craig notices a resurgence of that. I think I agree with that. I think Dan Dean has said that quite a bit, too. Philosopher Dan has said that.
I think it's quite a bit. For Lutherans, we've never been that strong, for good reason, in natural theology. Because we would always say that, we would certainly say, because Paul himself says it, Romans chapter 1 and 2, that people have this sort of sense of the divine. There is this sort of natural law written on our heart, that you can look at the stars at night, the design and the cosmos, and realize that there must be something behind it. But like C.S. Lewis, we'd say...
But thus everyone's left without an excuse, right?
Right. We'd certainly add that point. But we'd also say that's not the Christian God necessarily. C.S. Lewis in Mere Christianity says, even if you get to the point where you're like, oh, there must be a creator or designer behind it, that isn't Christian discourse yet.
First, and you're left with really the conclusion as you look and you observe the other things around you, like people, your interactions with them, death, disease, and all that, that not only must there be, but I must have done something against him.
Yeah.
If he's this angry. Is the case. He's angry.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you get essentially the best you can get is a God of law.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But despite Lutheran objections of natural theology, I do think, and I know we're coming to a break here soon, that there has been this kind of resurgence where in philosophy departments where for so long it's been very positivistic. It's kind of a good move, you know, that they're at least open to listening to arguments for something above nature or the material realm.
Right.
So, and that's all I'm saying there.
It is interesting. I've always, there won't be a conclusion in this episode of this, but, and I agree with it that through observation of the beauty of nature, the complexity of nature, just the wonder of nature, right, that you can get to the idea that there is something that must have done this because mm-hmm. it's so complex, it's so beautiful or whatever.
Yeah, but and there's the other side too. That is the problem of evil.
Right.
Nature read in tooth and claw.
Right.
When I was an agnostic, if you had made that move with your pawn, I would have countered with a pawn from the other
totally
side.
Agree, which, like I said, I did that. I said in the last episode, I just did the Q&A in Escondido at Community Lutheran Church, and problem of evil always comes up.
Always.
I mean, it's one of the six. I always say there's six questions that come up everywhere I go when I do this, and that's one of them. But it's interesting to me, and I'll just leave it at this, that we can get to the conclusion of an outside mover or whatever from beauty and sophistication and all that, but that the natural conclusion, because of the problem of evil, is a God of law.
Or worse.
And it's a beauty and the appreciation of it that gets you to a God of law. It's just interesting to me.
Yeah.
And deep thought.
That
by Scott
deep
Keith.
Thought. We're going to go to our break. So we'll be back in just a short second. Welcome to our break. Today we're going to talk again about the Crosswise Institute being hosted at Concordia University Irvine for high school age students. It's a theological sort of
camp. Kind of. Yeah, so it's Crosswise Institute. It's hosted at Concordia University Irvine. Adam, you work at Concordia, right?
I do.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is Crosswise Institute. This is something going on there. It's utilizing some of the great Concordia faculty that are already there. It's kind of like an advanced summer camp for high school age people, June 18th through 23rd. And the theme will be technology and transhumanism. Basically, what's happening is that Concordia, through this grant given by the Lilly Foundation, is bringing in some of the best thinkers in the country on this, secular and religious alike. Somebody, Zoltan Istvan, who is a famous transhumanist, Travis Hartgen, who's the planter of a church in Texas, a DCE, and has written on transhumanism quite a bit. Jesse Rice. He's the author of the Church of Facebook, and they're basically it'll be a mix of some sort of like daytime lectures by the faculty members and these other speakers on transhumanism. And Caleb, you did a great job explaining to the listeners what transhumanism was last time, so why don't you do it again?
Yeah, transhumanism is basically the philosophical belief that technology is improving so rapidly and so quickly that in a very short period of time here, that it will get good enough to interface with biology to the point where people will be able to expand their lifespan, they hope indefinitely or at least significantly at this point with the help of technology. And I guess some of the ultimate goal is uploading your consciousness or pieces of your consciousness into a one-day supercomputer type scenario that will allow you to live on forever.
Right. So I think you should check it out. I wish the URL was a little easier, but if you just put into your search engine Crosswise Institute, it'll come up. Caleb will put it in the show notes. And for basically what's going on here, for $300, your son or daughter, if you sign them up, gets a room and board, all sorts of special recreational activities for 6 days, Sunday evening through Friday morning. Wide range of learning experiences, big sessions, small group sessions, breakout sessions, led by some of the best Concordia faculty. Adam, are you teaching for this?
Nope.
Maybe we'll get Adam to teach for it too.
Nope.
and by leaders from all on the in this area from all over the country, students will be able to live on campus. Nationally known presenters, like I said, it's really an attempt at a confessional Lutheran perspective on this issue of transhumanism, taught in a way that's engaging for high school age students. If they want to know more about it, again, Crosswise Institute, they can put that in their search engine. Or look, I just found a good email address too. crosswise@cy.edu, crosswise@cy.edu.
Yeah, and I think, you know, for parents listening to this, like, why would I want to send my kid to a conference on transhumanism? I think one thing you're going to have to be aware of is even if it doesn't, you know, come about in the way that it's being proposed, these are questions that your kids are going to be forced to ask about themselves, or you want them to ask. I think as technology...
Yeah, you and I have these conversations all the time. Yeah. Every time a new Apple product comes out and you already have it, and I'm saying, why the hell are you wearing that watch that records your bio data?
Yeah, see, so, you know, he's already thinking, I don't ask those questions.
No, I know you do, because we've had the conversations. But I think a lot of people don't ask those questions.
No, I do too. And I think when it comes to technology, I don't think
Adam asked those questions.
It's no. You know, that we were so busy figuring out that we could that we didn't ask if we should type right. scenario. Yeah. And this kind of thing, you know, will put it in like a high schooler's mind who's going to be an adult on their own very soon, who needs to consider technological questions before just assuming that every advancement is actually for the better of society.
I think it's interesting. A lot of stuff that technologically has come out already, it's such that you can opt in or not opt in.
Yeah.
One of the scariest aspects of this to me is that I think technology is fast approaching. That's a, you know, if you don't opt out intentionally, you'll be opted in.
Well, I think a lot of the way they're doing this, not to make the whole episode about transhumanism, is through through healthcare systems.
Right. That's
so,
my point. Yeah.
Yeah, the technology is getting so fused with healthcare right. that and the way, you know, you legally are mandated to have healthcare exactly. right now, that eventually they'll say if you don't take this technological treatment or something like that, you owe a fine or something like that.
Rod, how do you feel about legally mandated healthcare plans?
well, we don't have 3 hours.
Okay.
So, part of something like this conference is just is probably in fact learning just how sneaky some of this stuff happens.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, I think that, you know, for the more mature listeners that we have, thinking why the heck would I want to know about this? Ask your kids, you know, who have an Apple Watch, if they thought about the fact that it records all their biometric data before they strapped it on. If the answer is no, you might want to send your kid here so they at least learn to think about these questions before they adopt this technology.
Yeah. All right. I think that's a good place to jump off.
Yeah, that was
now,
a pretty good hook. I'm going to use that again. All right.
Now, how the heck does this relate to Thomas Aquinas?
It doesn't.
It doesn't.
Thank philosophical-ish. You,
Adam. So, Dr. Francisco, Adam, where did we leave off?
I don't remember. I think we were covering the five ways.
Oh, yes. You finished talking about the five ways.
Little outline of the five ways. Yeah. And
We need to now talk about
natural theology.
Yeah. All right, guys. The whiskey's, you know, tipped into the I'm falling asleep stage here. But we need to talk about the theology and the theological yes. impact of Thomas Aquinas in right. the second half of the show. And, you know, why Lutherans don't get along with Thomas Aquinas?
Well, this is pretty easy. I mean, I'd like to say, just pose a question to the fellows. What was Thomas's position on sin and justification?
Sin is basically deep, deep weakness in need of healing. And there's your backdrop to the cross.
The picture you always used in class, which I remember to this day, is sort of I think it was World War I picture of how the medics would determine on a battlefield after World War I whether the person who was laying in the in the ditch was dead or just in need of help, that they'd use a mirror and put the mirror to their mouth, and if the mirror fogged up from their breath, even slight breath, then they were somebody in need of help, and if it didn't, they were dead. And that Thomas's view is that if that were to happen, if God were to do that to us, the mirror would fog up.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Ooh.
And this is the background to the cross. They're logically connected. Your view of sin is linked logically to your view of the cross. If you got a weak view of sin, your view of the cross is going to be correspondingly weak.
You know, that seems like a very simple statement, but theologically it's very profound, and it's one that our listeners need to grab onto, because this influences everything. I mean, not too long ago we did the episode with Donovan Riley on Luther. We ended up recording a quick special episode, which I don't think has dropped yet, on reading in the bondage of the will. But if you read the bondage of the will or anything like that, really the back question to that is, what can I do?
Sure.
Right? And the answer to the question of what can I do is linked to your view of sin.
Yep.
It's a great conversation for modern day evangelicalism, or like I said earlier, but maybe a better way of describing that is just sort of vanilla American non-denominationalism.
Yep.
Because really, if I understand that sort of system, if it is a system correctly, it's steeped in Thomistic theology when it comes to their view of sin.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty much the same thing that we have going on here.
Dr. Meyer, years and years ago, a conversation while we walked the campus, and he said, what do you think is the greatest doctrine that came out of the 16th century? And I said, justification of the sinner, by grace alone, through faith alone, on account of Christ's work alone. He said, I used to think that too. I said, what do you think it is? He said, I think the greatest contribution was a real view of sin.
I mean, the two are
that
so
was profound.
Yeah, those are so
they're so intrinsically tied that I think it's an interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know if I could oppose them against each other.
Well, what you come out with in classical Tridentine Roman Catholicism is God and you working together can save you.
Sure, that's right. But you got to do your part.
And the other thing is, and everybody has to realize this, everybody in the audience will say, that priest's position made sense. What Rosenblatt was getting at, I don't know what he was, do you know what he was getting at? And of course, I was talking about imputed righteousness.
Yeah.
But the priest, they recognize. That makes sense.
Sure.
Yeah, do your best and God will do the rest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you throw in imputed righteousness as the only, and the audience says, what's he getting at?
Yeah. Vicarious or substitutionary atonement.
Uh-huh.
Somebody took on my sin, exchanged my unrighteousness for their righteousness, and vice versa. It's crazy talk. Uh-huh. Crazy talk.
Well, the Middle Ages or the medieval church, though there are exceptions, generally sees things this way. And Thomas, he articulates what people have believed, and he will systematize it in a way such that it will become sort of the orthodox position up until the Reformation era, that people by nature, they're fallen to an extent, but grace kind of perfects their nature, and the way you receive that grace is through the infusion, if you will, of righteousness through the sacramental system.
Right.
I was hoping to get to that too, because I think that sometimes when we say this type of thing, people do have in their head modern day vanilla non-denominational evangelical Luther Christianity, which would just say that that's sort of making the first move towards God and or then doing your part after you've been saved.
Mm-hmm.
Where we're really within classical Roman Catholicism, what you're talking about is that part that you do is participation in the sacramental system.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, so if you want to say, well, what are the good works that I lend towards this that help save me? It's participation in the sacramental system by the church, because that's how you get the grace that's offered, that's out in the church.
You need God's grace in medieval Roman Catholic theology.
Absolutely.
But the grace thing is a substance.
They will say sola gratia.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
When I debated Carl Keating, his opening line was, I'm going to say that salvation is sola gratia. And Dr. Rosenblatt's going to be surprised. Well, of course I wasn't, because the way they define grace.
Yeah.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. The thing they would never say is sola fide, ever.
Right. Yeah. And it's even their sola gratia is sort of like going to 31 Flavors and getting 7 scoops of ice cream, right?
It's, sure.
It's, yeah. It's a thing that the priest alone, yep, really, has the authority to dole out. Mm-hmm. Like somebody scooping a thing of vanilla ice cream and sticking it on your cone.
And what Dr.
Scoop by scoop by scoop by scoop.
And what Dr. Horton uses as illustration is it's a bathtub that's always leaking.
So you got to fill it back up.
Yeah, the ice cream's always melting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Right? So you got to go back and get more.
So we don't even think, well, finally it ended up where Carl Keating said, that's only because you're using a Protestant dictionary.
Sure.
But a lot of Tridentine Catholics will now finally admit that the use of dikaios is what Luther said it was and wasn't what the Pope said it was. Mm. Now, they're maybe on their way out of the church. I don't know. But it doesn't come down to you have a lexicon that was written by the wrong guy.
So what else do we need to know about Thomas's theology? We got his five ways. That was an incredible sort of impact. And
we talked earlier about his language concerning God. I think we covered that at least for a few minutes.
I mean, sin and grace, that's seminal. I mean, in his understanding of sin and grace is one of the big things that the Reformation was reacting against.
Oh, yeah. If I knew nothing else about Thomas other than how does he tell me that I can be saved, that's about all I'd need to know.
Right.
Because I'd be defeated. Mm-hmm. He'd say, no, but there's grace. There's grace. And I'd say, the kind you're talking about, I don't recognize in the New Testament.
Right.
Yeah. And it'd be almost over.
Yeah. And from the historian's vantage point with Thomas, right after he dies, his works, people are prohibited by the Pope. To read,
that's a weird part of the story.
Yeah. Like 13th, 14th century, he's kind of a nobody.
Well, he kind of takes on his deathbed, he kind of takes a lot of stuff back, too.
Well, towards his last year, maybe a couple of years of his life, he has some sort of mystical experiences, right, in the plural, and he's done writing. But his writings are prohibited, you're prohibited from reading them. And he's not influential for about a century and a half. But then when we get into the 15th and 16th century, there's a resurgence of Thomism. And when Luther gets put on trial after his nailing or posting the 95 Theses, his inquisitors are primarily Thomists. Mm-hmm. Kajetan or Kajetan.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard it in several ways.
Mm-hmm. Dude, your fancy pronunciations.
Well, I get confused. There's the American.
Can you give us
British,
the Donovan Riley, North... Minnesota pronunciation.
No,
as well.
I'm SoCal. Yeah. All the way, but, Kajetan and the rest of them, they're all thoroughgoing Thomists. Pope Leo the X, one of
his, that's right.
He had all sorts of programs going on, but one of them was a revival of and a elevation of Thomas and his theology as sort of the orthodox theology of the Catholic Church.
Forever.
And it gets reasserted. Throughout the ages, Vatican I, there's a reassertion of Thomism as a way to combat modernism, and it's in the Baltimore Catechism. That's the theology of the Baltimore Catechism.
Absolutely. If somebody wants to know what is Council of Trent Catholicism, go to your local parish. They'll have in the basement a closet with 250 of them stacked, and the priest will just say, "How many would you like?" But it's the real thing.
Yeah. It's like our old red hymnal.
Yeah.
Oh, jeez. We made 250 of them stacked in the basement,
We have to take pictures of Dr. Rosenblatt's face as we're in his response.
All right.
Well,
we're done.
Well, I think that sums up our second episode on Aquinas. We have a lot of new listeners listening to the show. Don't think I don't see you every week, a new listener. And if you are new, we need you to please help us out. If you could go on iTunes or on Google Play or wherever you listen to this podcast and go ahead and give us a rating. 5 stars only, please.
No.
As a former car salesman, Caleb can actually say only the 5 star.
Yeah, only the 5 star, or I'd lose my job.
Yeah.
Maybe. I don't know. But, yeah, please go rate us on iTunes or send us an email. If this show's impacted you in any way, we'd love to hear how. And so you can go to thinkingfellows.com, and we have the Contact Us button. And you click that, and you just fill it out, and it goes straight to my inbox, and I'll share that with the rest of the fellows. All right, we'll catch you next time.
Thank you.